We finally got the word from the mountaintop about interest rates, and as usual, the word is not much word at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, August 26th, and thank you for being here today. Let's begin, as we do on Fridays, with our weekly wrap-up of the big economic stories of the week. Here with me now are Neela Richardson from Redfin and Cardiff Garcia of FT Alphaville. Hey there.
Hey, Molly.
Hi, Molly.
So it is my reading, based on the internet, that there is nothing to talk about after Janet Yellen's Federal Reserve speech in Jackson Hole. But I'm going to ask you to dig deep into your analysis bag of tricks and tell me, Cardiff, what'd you hear?
Yeah, I don't think it's quite right that there's nothing to talk about. I think Janet Yellen was trying to do a couple of things. One was lay the groundwork for the possibility, not the certainty, but the possibility that there is going to be a rate rise coming up soon, possibly even in September. There was a line in her speech saying that the case has strengthened for a rate rise coming soon. So I think that's something to watch, and other members of the Fed have been saying that. I think she was also trying to grapple with a question that's really been bedeviling central banks all throughout the world, including the Fed, which is what happens if the economy weakens again and interest rates are already really close to zero. And so she laid out a few possible ideas, and I think what she's trying to do is to start developing the intellectual space for further discussions of that, and that's not such a bad idea. So yeah, there was something to talk about there. There's we can fill up these 4 minutes.
I'm not worried about our 4 minutes, but Neela, what did you think? It sounded cautious, but like Cardiff said, right, maybe laid. I like this idea of intellectual space.
You know, the Fed is in such a tough spot right now. I mean, they're borderline the boy who cried hawk instead of wolf. They're trying to appear hawkish, that like they might indeed raise rates in September. But we know that any flicker of trouble from abroad could flame out that desire to raise rates. And any slowdown in the U.S., as hinted by corporate earnings in the second quarter, could also make them a little resistant to increase. So it is an uneasy place for Janet Yellen to be in, to assure markets that, in fact, the Fed might raise rates when the markets themselves don't believe her yet.
Well, and we have this Commerce Department report today saying that even last quarter's GDP growth, which we thought was pretty good at 1.2%, was actually more like 1.1%. And like you said, maybe these indicators aren't that strong after all. Cardiff, what do you think?
Yeah, so I actually found some reasons for optimism in that report. Believe it or not, growth definitely hasn't been strong, but jobs growth and even wage growth have been improving the last couple of months, and those are good signs. There's been profound disappointment in the level of business investment in the U.S. for a few years now, and that certainly continues. But it's also the case that the consumer is still spending. People are still spending money. And so long as I think jobs growth continues, I think that will be the case. And it might take a little while to translate into stronger economic growth. But I don't think that there were enough really pessimistic signs in that report for us to start worrying. If anything, quite the opposite.
Neela, what about productivity? That seems like that was a big story, you know, that got a little buried in that report, which is that productivity is in its longest, worker productivity, it's in its longest slide since the 70s. What is that? Can you break that down for us? What does that mean? And what does it mean going forward?
I wish I shared more of Cardiff's optimism, actually. The fact of the matter is that the economy continues to produce jobs, and yet the economy doesn't produce growth. And the missing link there is productivity. We're just not making those big innovations that increase worker productivity, increase wages over the long term. And you see that translated in very sluggish economic growth going forward. It doesn't matter how many jobs we produce. We're not seeing incomes rise. We're not seeing standards of living rise. And that is an ongoing long-term concern for the Fed.
See plenty for 4 minutes. Cardiff Garcia and Neela Richardson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Molly. Yeah.
Thanks, Molly.
On Wall Street today, markets really, really wanted to like Janet Yellen's remarks from Jackson Hole, but then her vice chairman went and buzzkilled it by suggesting a rate hike for sure in September, and now nobody knows what to do. We'll find out where everybody landed when we do the numbers. Let's keep talking about slow growth and falling prices, this time, though, because of competition. America's biggest grocery chains are locked in a deli counter cage match, you might say, and food prices are tanking as a result. Discount retailer Dollar General said yesterday that it's cutting prices on hundreds of items across 2,000 stores. Walmart, Kroger, Trader Joe's, all the same story. And now cutting costs to get people in the door is a time-tested strategy, but it isn't good for margins. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Grocery stores are feeling the pinch these days, whether it's from online retailers or changing tastes. In fact, legacy brands are also worried about losing market share.
Whether it's Kraft, whether it's Heinz, whether it's Unilever.
Phil Limpert is the editor of SupermarketGuru.com. He says manufacturers are cutting prices too. This is good for stores because they can pass those savings on to customers, but it also means they have to find new ways to sell more product at slimmer margins.
They might have to commit to higher quantities or specials or coupons, but their idea is to get those prices down as cheap as possible and get customers coming into the door.
So that's great, right? Customers walk in and walk out with more bang for their buck.
What they don't tell you is they're raising prices on other items to make up for it.
So says supermarket analyst David Livingston. He says retail grocers will never win the battle for customers on price alone.
Because you will not out Walmart Walmart.
In fact, Walmart has planned to slash prices even more on high traffic items such as fresh fruit and laundry detergent. $10 billion in cash reserves can buy you that luxury. A much better strategy, says Livingston, is to exploit another niche, whether it's better customer service or high-quality produce.
Whole Foods didn't get where they're at by having low prices. They've gotten where they're at by being the whole paycheck.
Back in the low-cost space, European grocers Aldi and Lidl actually do have prices lower than Walmart. Both are planning rapid expansions in the United States. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
This next piece of news might surprise you. There is still a fall TV season. Yeah, it still exists, which means that in the ocean of other content there is for you to watch or listen to or read or maybe all three at the same time, TV shows on regular old broadcast television have to find a way to get noticed. And despite that seemingly large-ish challenge, preseason ad sales are actually the highest they've been in the last few years. And as Marketplace's Rima Crace reports, those aren't the only glory days the networks are trying to relive.
Not one, not two, but three new shows about time travel are coming to three different networks. NBC's is called Timeless.
I think Flynn is trying to rewrite history. It could change the present in ways we can't possibly predict.
Flynn is not the only one trying to rewrite history. The networks themselves are jumping into a kind of time machine. Along with their usual shows about doctors, lawyers, and cops, they're adapting movies and reviving old series. Brian Lowry is a longtime TV critic.
The conclusion they have sort of made is that it's so hard standing out and so hard getting noticed that the easiest way to do that is to come at people with a property that they already recognize.
Fox, which is looking to pull itself out of last place among the networks, is introducing The Exorcist and Lethal Weapon. CBS is bringing back MacGyver. It's also launching Kevin Can Wait, starring Kevin James. It'll fill the time slot once occupied by The King of Queens, starring Kevin James.
So it's almost like you're in a time warp. If you woke up today, you would see Kevin James looking pretty much the same, just with a new wife and new kids.
All in all, networks are unveiling more than 20 new shows this fall. So are streaming services like Netflix and Amazon. And then there are all of the cable shows. It's easy to get lost in the crowd. Larry Gerbrandt is with Media Evaluation Partners.
Yeah, it's very difficult to create word-of-mouth momentum, social media momentum, when you only can reach 2% of the public.
So Gerbrandt says networks rely most on what they've already done right.
But once you have a successful show, you can then promote other shows within that successful show.
Or in the case of NBC, once you have the Olympics, you can plug your shows and programming more than 3,000 times. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
You know, it's kind of funny if you think about it that the Federal Reserve holds its big summer symposium in Jackson Hole. They're talking about monetary policy that affects the masses in a big resort town that's so expensive that the people who work there can't afford to live there. kind of a common story with big ski resort towns like Aspen, Colorado, where the housing market is, in a word, bananas. About half the population lives in affordable housing. And on the other hand, a home in a trailer park can sell for $1 million. City leaders tried to head off the problem about 40 years ago with an innovative affordable housing program, but it's starting to show its age. From Colorado Public Radio, Ben Marcus reports.
You wouldn't think it to look at her, but some see Sarah Garten as a threat to Aspen's affordable housing system. She owns a small one-bedroom with a great built-in cabinet.
Is this IKEA?
This is an old boyfriend ski patrolman who was a terrific carpenter. And I said, Timmy, I need a bookcase, and I need a place to put my TV. And he says, we're going to build you a whole unit.
Garten has a twinkle in her eye that makes her seem younger than 74. The former copy editor has lived in this affordable housing unit for 30 years.
So we are in what we call the black hole of affordable housing. Can't get out. I can't afford this lifestyle in Newcastle.
Newcastle is about an hour and a half down valley, on the interstate, and a lot cheaper. Why would she sell her Aspen condo? She could only get less than $200,000 for it because it's part of the affordable housing program. If it were on the free market, she'd get $1 million. There's no retirement home here, and she doesn't want to leave the city she's called home for decades. What started as housing for the workforce is increasingly becoming retirement housing, raising fundamental questions about the program.
The people that created the program back in the 70s, they never thought they were going to get old. And they never thought the buildings were going to get old.
Aspen City Councilman Adam Frisch drives his SUV through town, passing fund managers in Ferraris and bartenders on bicycles. He says Aspen was ahead of its time developing a system so both could live here. Other resort towns like Jackson Hole, Wyoming, have copied a lot from it. But the former currency trader says controlling the price of half the city's homes has had unintended consequences.
When you have an unlimited demand for something and you put a capped price on it, regardless of what it is, market forces get out of whack.
Half of the units in the program are rentals, but it's the owner-occupied units that are causing Frisch heartache. Most were built decades ago, and many haven't been maintained because there's little incentive to fix up a home when the price is capped, so a homeowner can't realize any big gain from the improvement. Plus, there can be up to 60 bids on it despite its condition. And then there's a looming problem of what to do with retirees, who technically don't qualify for workforce housing. Mike Kozdrowski runs the housing program. He says half of the residents in Aspen's affordable housing units are 10 to 20 years from retirement. It's unlikely most will leave.
It's a ticking time bomb. And if we're not going to address it, then we're going to be in a world of pain 10 years down the line.
And Aspen's development restrictions mean they can't build many more units. Now it's getting harder for people to win the lottery to get a coveted unit. Yeah, you have to win a lottery.
The old way of the lottery used to be ping pong balls, and they used to do it in a very public way in a big ballroom at the local hotel.
Now it's more humane, done by computer. Still, there are perennial lottery losers like Christine Benedetti, a freelance journalist. She's started a group to advocate for younger families, hoping to push the city to solve the retiree issue, for one. In the meantime, she's on the outside of Aspen looking in, living 20 minutes away from the culture and the jobs.
We had someone who won a $500,000 lotto ticket at the gas station, and you still can't buy a home for that much. So you want to win the housing lottery over the actual lottery.
With the average price of a single-family home now more than $5 million, she's not kidding. In Aspen, I'm Ben Marcus for Marketplace.
Coming up,
she went above and beyond to make sure I stayed in school.
Investing in your workforce before you even hire them. But first, let's do the numbers. Mixed results today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average threw off 0.25%, 53 points, to close at 18,395. The S&P 500 unloaded 0.1%. That's about 3 points, to finish at 2169. But the NASDAQ went the other way, adding 0.1%, or 8 points. It ended the day at 5220. For the week, the Dow dipped 0.8%. The S&P dropped 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 0.3%. Now, whatever message financial firms think Janet Yellen was sending today, they liked the sound of it. Bank of America up 1 7/10. Citigroup 9/10%. Morgan Stanley stepped up 0.75%. Morgan Chase, JP Morgan Chase picked up 0.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. All right, let's try a little experiment. We are going to tell you a story about millennials. And whether you're a millennial or a boomer or an Xer, you're probably thinking, I'm pretty sure I know what kind of story this is going to be. You're thinking you've already heard whatever cliche or stereotype we are about to trot out. But what if we didn't do that? What if a recent survey about retirement savings actually told a whole different story than the one you're expecting? Let me blow your mind. Okay. There are a couple cliches in here, but only for illustration. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
Far from the image of millennials as flighty, parents' basement-dwelling, work-avoiding, self-absorbed emoji lovers, a cross-generational survey about retirement savings finds they seem to get the new realities.
Millennials are getting a big head start on saving for retirement compared to other generations.
Catherine Collinson is president of the Transamerica Center for Retirement Studies, which does the annual survey. It's a nonprofit that gets funding from the insurance company. The survey finds the median millennial started saving for retirement at age 22. Far sooner than Gen X or baby boomer folks did, and millennials are more than twice as likely to have regular talks about their personal finances. Douglas Bonaparte is a financial planner and a millennial himself.
We saw throughout our childhood and into adulthood the decline of pensions are almost non-existent. So we're very aware that when it comes to retirement or financial independence, it's something that we have to take into our own hands.
But that's not to say that millennials are all set. Matt Rutledge is an economist at the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
Every generation really underestimates how much they're going to need to save for retirement. And the millennials are certainly no exception there.
That's in line with what Mary Beth Storjahan sees. She's a financial planner with many younger clients.
Even when they're saving, depending on what their income is, it might not be enough. I think a lot of people don't understand what is enough.
And that's a question every generation has to deal with. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There are, and this is a good cliche, a helpful one, it is safe to say there are a lot of unknowns in business. But one thing we do know, study after study shows that companies with a good mix of gender, race, and ethnicity benefit in the bottom line. But what about local education systems that don't produce enough qualified candidates? That is a known problem in Minnesota, where the population is becoming more diverse, but only about a quarter of African Americans and Latinos have college degrees, compared to more than half of white adults. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports on one effort to close the gap.
Shayla Thacker had a rough start at the University of Minnesota. They were the usual freshman adjustments, living away from home for the first time, the workload.
And then in the classes, there's not too many students that kind of fit my profile.
By profile, she means
an African-American student that are first-generation college students from single-parent households that are below the poverty line, that profile.
But Thacker had one big advantage. She was part of a scholarship program aimed at reshaping Minnesota's workforce. Along with $4,000 a year for school, she was paired up with a professional advisor to help get her through college.
Having those check-ins with my advisor, I knew that, wow, I really have someone that is like invested and really cares about my success. She went above and beyond to make sure I stayed in school.
The program is called Wallen Education Partners. It was created more than 20 years ago by the late Winston Wallen, a businessman who'd made his name at Pillsbury. Steve Lewis is an economist and chairman of the board.
It was obvious to Win that there was a demographic problem coming for the workforce.
Lewis says what Wallen saw coming was that the numbers of Black, Latino, and immigrant students in the state were growing, and too many of those students were living in poverty and not making it through school.
We're going to have a major deficit of college and university-trained people if we don't do something about the high school and college completion rates for the current demographic of students.
To qualify for the Wallen Scholarship, high school seniors in the Twin Cities need at least a B average and a 19 out of 36 on the ACT. Their families have to earn less than $75,000 a year, though the average is less than $25,000. And this is key. Unless they choose one of the country's historically black colleges, they have to go to college in Minnesota or one of its neighboring states. Susan Basil King is executive director of Wallen Education Partners.
What we were really interested in is homegrown talent. And if a student goes to college in the five-state area, they tend to stay in our community and work and live here.
Fostering the local workforce is part of Wallen's pitch to a growing list of corporate partners. Fortune 500 companies like General Mills and U.S. Bank now fund a crop of Wallen scholars each year and offer them paid summer internships. At U.S. Bank, 18-year-old Fatima Ahmad sits in a row of interns in the wealth management department, sifting through market data in an Excel spreadsheet.
I had no idea how to do this like 4 weeks ago, but they just sort of hand it to you and then guide you a little bit, and then you look up the rest on the internet.
Ahmad just finished her first year at the University of Minnesota. She's the daughter of Somali refugees, and with her long skirt and headscarf, she stands out in a sea of young white guys in collared shirts.
My summer has been filled with doing everything from marketing to data entry to analyzing revenue, and so being able to help on that is an experience that you don't get to have in college, per se.
Jenny Carlson is U.S. Bank's head of human resources. She says the hope is that students like Ahmad will work for the bank after they graduate. And more than 90% of Wallen scholars do graduate.
Diverse organizations make more money, are stronger, have better results, also have better working environments and more engaged employees.
She says the investment isn't philanthropy. It comes out of the bank's talent development budget.
For us, the customers of the future and our workforce need to match.
And right now, they don't. Despite its efforts, U.S. Bank is still predominantly white, especially at the top. Recruiting minority employees from out of state can be tough. After a few winters, a lot of people don't last. But out of the 4,000 Wallen scholars who've graduated since the program started, 80% are still living and working in the Twin Cities.
So this is the old First National Bank building.
One of them is Shayla Thacker, the student we met at the beginning of the story. She finished her degree in May and landed a full-time job training to be a commercial loan portfolio manager at U.S. Bank. Her office on the 22nd floor of the U.S. Bank Tower has a sweeping view of downtown St. Paul.
Then we have the Mississippi River that I can see throughout. So that's really cool.
Inside, she has pictures of her younger siblings. They're still at home with her mom, who's disabled and gets by on government assistance. Thacker helps pay for things like summer camp and school clothes.
They definitely help motivate me to kind of really push for success and be their example. So
Minnesota could have lost Thacker. She had planned to go to college out of state, but turned down Georgetown and Penn to go to the U of M.
The more time that I spend here, I see the more benefits of it, you know. I like to say that maybe one day I'll just get a winter home somewhere, but I can stay here for the rest of the time.
Just what Win Wallen was hoping for when he started this program in 1992. And he lived to see very directly the impact of his investment. When he was being treated for cancer 6 years ago at the end of his life, one of the doctors he met in the hospital had been a Wallen scholar. In the Twin Cities, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace. This final note before we go, Panasonic and Sony are teaming up to produce and sell 8K TVs by 2020. These are televisions that offer essentially 8 times the resolution of a standard HD TV set, because apparently when it comes to TV screen resolution, you can never have too many Ks. Or can you? Now seems like a good time for the return of my new segment, Tech Intervention. Because you know what? You can have too many Ks. We are not going to need 8K TVs in 2020. That's because manufacturers are still trying to get us to buy
4K TVs. You know, ultra high definition. See, remember when we all moved to high def and there was hardly any content in high def? Well, there is almost no content in 4K, so almost no one is buying 4K TVs. About 6 million of them have been sold in the United States. There are more Apple Watches than ultra-high-def TVs out there. The TV industry has been tanking as televisions become a commodity, so trust me when I tell you that making even higher resolution televisions at even higher prices just to show off a couple of nature videos and one or two Sony Pictures films is not the jumpstart you're looking for. That is it for this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow threw off 0.25%. That was 53 points. S&P 500 off 0.1%, but the NASDAQ added 0.1% just to make up for it. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fergali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I am Molly Wood. We'll be back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.